Homer, not the cartoon character, but the sculpture in Marlins Park may be getting a new home. Just not anytime soon. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Miami-Dade County Commission has failed to agree on where to move the much-maligned art piece that sits in the outfield at Marlins Park. We go back to a conversation with art critic Brett Sokol about the origins of that sculpture and what should happen to it. Also, author Edwige Danticat is a finalist for another prestigious literary award. We spoke to her in 2017 about her latest work, The Art of Death. She wrote that piece as part of her journey after her mother's passing. We'll hear more about that journey and how she brought it all together. Also, today, a look at the National School Walkout. That's all coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Today, tens of thousands of high school students across the country stopped in the middle of class and walked out. It's part of the national walkout movement created in the wake of the Parkland shooting in Broward County that ended with 17 dead. WLRN's Tim Padgett and Katie Lepre went to Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School this morning. Now, all the students walked out. They weren't allowed to leave campus, so they walked out to the football field. And so, of course, we couldn't speak to any of the students or staff, but there were a lot of folks on the other side of the fence, residents, even students from FIU, who showed up to basically applaud them.
MSD! 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 MSD!
Now, we're going to have more on this story a little later in the program. But again today, we're in the spring membership campaign, and we want to remind you that your support helps make this show possible, and it makes it stronger. Today, we're going to go back to one of our favorite conversations with local author and Haitian rights activist Edwige Danticat. She's the 25th laureate of the Neustadt International Prize for Literature. We spoke to her about her most recent book, The Art of Death, a personal story about her mother's passing. It's a finalist for a National Book Critics Circle Award. The winners will be announced on Thursday. We pick up where Edwige shared what she was thinking about shortly after her mother's death.
Well, my mom passed away about 3 years ago. And after that, I was really stuck about what I wanted to write next. And I felt like I didn't want to write. It was still fresh, so I didn't want to rewrite what I had just lived through. And people kept giving me books. I think that's something that a lot of people, when they're mourning, realize. You get, you know, people will give you books of poems. You'll get a lot of C.S. Lewis, like A Grief Observed, you know, like as means of comfort. And I started reading those books and then rereading books that had always turned to when writing about death or when facing my own grief. And so that's really how the whole project of the book started.
When you start working on a story based on this experience with your mother, she was diagnosed with a cancer.
Ovarian, yeah.
And when it's over, I can only imagine, I mean, you need some time to process that and, of course, go through your mourning period. But, you know, at what point do you decide, okay, I need to share this story in some way?
Well, I think as writers, we sort of have the practice. I have the practice, you know, speaking for myself, of both living an experience and seeing it from the outside in sort of a narrative way. And I think even as I was going through this process with my mother, I was narrating it to myself in some way. And so I started, when I was reading, I would take notes, and then the idea of sharing comes after, when you know what you have, when you have a shape to something. And the more I read, the more I noted it down, and really once the projects had merged, you know, this idea of talking about grief and talking about loss and also examining in this really distant way how others have done it as a way of seeking comfort. Only when all that was done did I feel like sharing. And I think with the projects of all these books, all the books we read about mourning, what their project is to make others feel like they're not alone. And so in this book, I was really trying to speak to the heart, but also in some ways to the intellect. And maybe that was a distancing mechanism, so I wasn't crying on every page.
Do you think that we just do that naturally? We try to see death intellectually so that it doesn't... death is a very difficult topic to talk to anybody about. And for some people, they don't even want to discuss it because mm-hmm. there's a lot of fear involved. There's a lot of questions about, well, what's next, or is that the finality of everything? But do you think that it's just natural for us to want to approach it from that intellectual perspective as a safeguard?
Yeah, I think death is a very hard topic because it's all around us, you know, even as we live in this time that it seems as though, you know, even this month that we've been through with Vegas and all the hurricanes and all the devastation, and we hear about death every day, but we tend to hear about it in a global way. But when it comes into our lives, when someone very close to us dies, it always feels new. It always feels like it's just happening to us. And I think the you know, mortality itself is something that's hard to deal with. I just, you know, when you're a kid, you don't even think about mortality. And then when people at the other end, you start reviewing your life. And so it's not, I try to treat it as, it's not as much of a downer as possibly, because even the dying people in my life, my father had a terminal illness and spent a long time dying, my mom less so, but they had time to reflect. And then even writers like Christopher Hitchens, who wrote as he was dying, and Audre Lorde, all those people, you know, the dying, what they tell us, you know, what I find that in my reading and my own personal experience, what they tell us most profoundly and most emphatically is to live, you know, because people who are at the end, the regrets that they have are things that hadn't done, people they hadn't told that they loved. And so it's not as much as a downer. If you think there is an end, then you sort of really relish and cherish and really live the moments you do have.
How often do you think about your own mortality?
Well, all the time. I think if you have children, you think about it more hesitantly because you really want to see them through so many milestones and you want to be there. So I think, and also if you're writing other people's lives all the time, right? You write characters and sometimes you have to put an end to their lives. And what I've found as I've gotten older is that I do that less lightly. You know, I think about the weight of lives and sort of what we leave behind. And I feel lucky that I have this work that sort of will speak for me, even if it's only read after I'm gone by the people closest to me. But that extends one's mortality a little bit when you have something that you've created that you've left behind. And some people see that in children. Some people see that in their artwork. And some people see that in the good works that they have done.
You're listening to an encore presentation of a conversation we had with local author Edwige Dantecott. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We're going to go back now to an encore broadcast of a conversation we had with local author Edwige Dantecott. We're discussing her latest book, The Art of Death, a personal story about her mother's passing. Let's go back to our conversation with Edwige.
I think about, because we're both in that stage of life where we have seen and we have lost people close to us, and so it forces you to think about your mortality maybe a little bit more, but if you do or when you do think about it, what are your feelings about death itself?
Again, as the people who...
Your death, by the way.
My own?
Yeah, you're thinking about your own death. That moment when you're going
to leave.
We're
really going there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and one of the things I had to face in this writing of this book, too, is that we often imagine our death like it is on TV and, you know, that you'll have final words and not everybody gets that. And it's something that we don't know. It could be like an instant, the unpredictability of it. And I think that's the part where I think that my mom used to say that she didn't want to long a death and she didn't want too short. She wanted something in between, and that's exactly what she got. I mean, I would wish that I would have said everything that I wanted to say to the people I love the most, and that I would go out with them knowing that I love them and that I treasure them, and I think that would be most important to me.
Are you afraid of death?
Only because I have kids. Otherwise, I think I would be more philosophical. I would be afraid to leave behind my children.
Yeah. In this book, again, as we mentioned, is the fact that you also bring in you know, the perspective of other writers. And I'm starting to think now maybe these were writers you were reading during this mourning period. I mean, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Toni Morrison, as you mentioned, Christopher Hitchens. Who are some of the authors that you were reading, and how did you bring in their approach to their own mortality and death in how you were telling the story of your mother?
Well, they were people, good friends had given me a collection of poems by Lucille Clifton. And one of the poems was, it's called O Antic God. And she says, O Antic God, give to me my mother in her 30s. And it's about a daughter imagining what her mother was like when she was younger. And then the book, the C.S. Lewis, A Grief Observed, where he talks about the death of his wife from cancer. And he says to her, you know, come back to me on my deathbed. And then she says, you know, heaven will have a hard time holding me. And in the Bible, you know, my mom and I used to read the Bible together because she was also, I think, in the end, trying to figure out what lay ahead. She was a very religious woman. And so all of those, you know, were on repeat for me in terms of reading. And there's something that this in the C.S. Lewis book, he talks about an element of anticipatory grief, where you're sort of anticipating your grief as you watch someone die. And there's something very profound about seeing somebody take their last breath that really encourages one to kind of, you know, live up, live well until that moment.
How do you think that death in fiction or nonfiction, but, you know, death in fiction helps us in handling our mortality?
Well, one thing they've done study with fiction in that when we read some things, when we enter an experience, we feel as though we've lived it a little bit. I think death in fiction takes away a little bit of the fear of death that a lot of people have. I mean, for 100 Years of Solitude, the Marquez, for example, there's so much death in that book, but every, you know, countering every moment in that, there's also so much life. You know, these lives are very well lived, and I think in 100 Years of Solitude of that, this young woman, because in that book, it almost predates death. So there were no cemeteries when the book began. And there's one woman who's just carrying the bones of her ancestors, of her parents with her. And I think of sort of the metaphorical element of that. We sort of all carry some element of our ancestors with us. And their lives, you know, the traces of their lives that they left behind, the good example, the good works, are in some ways always with us.
If they write, if your children were to write a book about you the same way you did your mother, what would you hope they get in that story? Or what do you hope that story is going to be that you're leaving for them?
Well, you know, ultimately, I think all the stories we write are our stories. You know, my mother had an extraordinary life. She was an immigrant from Haiti. She was undocumented when she came to New York and left two children behind, me and my brother, and then we were separated for 8 years. I mean, it was a very heartbreaking in some moments life. But at the end, we came together, and both my parents, as they were dying, you know, when my father was dying about 10 years ago, my brother asked him, did you enjoy your life? And he said, you know, I didn't have vacations, I didn't make tons of money, but I had you guys. And that was the whole project of our immigration, of everything. And I know my mom felt the same way, because she left us a cassette with her, among instructions to, you know, with between what to wear to the funeral and all that. You know, she said she was glad that she had made this journey, everything in her life, because of how we came out. I think I would want my children to realize that there were a lot of bumps on the road, you know, a lot of obstacles, but that so much had been sacrificed for a better life.
You've been listening to a previous conversation we had with local author Edwige D'Entecott, who's a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. The winners will be announced on Thursday. In a few minutes, we're going to talk with art critic Brett Sokol about the debate over the Mimi Marlin's home run sculpture. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It has been reported that Derek Jeter, one of the owners of the Miami Marlins, is not exactly crazy about Homer, the home run sculpture at Marlins Park. Miami-Dade County officials are looking for another location for the Red Groom's artwork. We spoke recently with Brett Sokol, arts editor of Ocean Drive magazine and a regular contributing writer of arts and culture to the New York Times. And we asked him about the search for Homer's new, well, home.
Okay, look, I've been to the park a few times, and I remember the first time that I saw it. I thought, tacky, but neat. Neat, you know.
That's a kind way to put it.
It grew on me, though. I thought, but that's, it's Miami. What, you know, what's the big deal?
I wouldn't say it's grown on you and the rest of Miami so much as you've gotten used to it, like a canker sore, maybe.
Oh, my goodness.
But let's back up, because there's a reason why we're talking, when we talk about this sculpture by Red Grooms, that people have very strong opinions and people's blood pressure tends to rise a bit, because it's not just another piece of public art. And it is public. It's owned by the taxpayers of Miami-Dade. They paid for it, all $2.45 million of it. Again, it's not in a park somewhere with trees around. It is in the middle of Marlins Park, which is, most economists at this point would agree, the single worst public-private sports arena deal in modern times. I mean, it is just a bad deal, is putting it mildly, again, is the way that most economists look at this thing. The whole project itself cost $650 million, 75% of which was paid by Miami's taxpayers.
And we're talking about the park. The
right,
whole park.
The park and the parking lots. But that's not the real number. The real number is $2 billion, because we had to float bonds to pay for this thing, and we have to pay the interest on those bonds. So by the time that Marlins Baseball Park is finally paid off in full, it will have cost the taxpayers in this city $2 billion.
Am I hearing from you that basically then this sculpture is representative of that, you know, this hideous deal and the cost to the taxpayers, that we're just going to blame it on this? All we're going to do is focus on this sculpture as basically the epicenter of that anger and hatred.
I think that would be unfair to the artist, Red Grooms, but there's some truth in that. It's a very easy target for a lot of people who are looking at this deal, even people who originally supported it back in 2009 and now realize that they were sold a bill of goods. A lot of promises were made about what this park was going to do, not just in terms for baseball, but for Miami, how it was going to revitalize the whole area around the park, and all kinds of restaurants and retail were going to pop up, and hundreds of thousands of people were going to be flying into Miami just to go to this baseball park and spend lots of money. And it turns out none of this panned out.
I mean, all right, so look, how do you view it as, I mean, do you see it as art? How would the art critic, Brett Sokol, describe
well,
his thoughts on this sculpture?
Again, we're kind of being a little unfair to Red Grooms here. He is a wonderful artist. He has a career spanning back decades to really the dawn of the 1960s. He's got a lot of very important works. I don't know if this is one of them. It's certainly one of the largest that he's done, but it's he is known for a whimsical approach. All right, his work is very colorful. It's almost cartoon-like in many aspects. Roberta Smith, the art critic at the New York Times, once compared his work to a big, large, excited dog that bounds at you and knocks you over and then licks your face.
This does that.
Some people like that. Some people don't. And I think, you know, when we look at this stadium, again, this baseball park, we were told that if Miami wanted to be a world-class city, it had to pay for this park. And I'm not sure that this sculpture signifies world-class anything.
And how was this sculpture chosen?
Well, it was there was a public competition, but it does seem as though Red Grooms had the inside track here. The previous owner of the Marlins who put this all together, Jeffrey Loria, had dealt in some art. Just how extensive his career as an art dealer was is up to some debate. Certainly he wasn't much of a presence in the art world by the time he was running the Marlins, but he did have an affection for Red Grooms, whose work he seemed to have sold back in the 70s and 80s. And he reached out to Red Grooms and said, hey, you should enter into this public competition. Lo and behold, Red Grooms won. And $2.45 million worth of tax dollars were used to purchase this piece. It was designed in coordination with Art in Public Places and the Florida Marlins. I mean, this is interesting. Is there's an interview with Red Grooms where he talks about the process of creating this thing. And it didn't just spring from his mind fully formed. His original design, parts of it were rejected by the Marlins and Art in Public Places. He originally had pelicans in there instead of flamingos. And someone came to him and said either they didn't like the idea of pelicans or the pelican really isn't a Miami bird. But in any case, these things change. It evolved over time. I mean, originally, if you think it's sort of crazy now, going off every time there's a home run, his original idea was that it would go off every time somebody hit a ball. It would do one thing if there was a single, another if there was a double, a triple. I mean, it would have gone off like every single play. You would have, you know, you buy a hot dog and a beer at the game, they would have handed you a bottle of aspirin at the same time. That was rejected. So now we have it. It just goes off. If somebody hits a home run, which doesn't happen very often with the Marlins, but
I would say this past year, they had a couple of guys who were home run hitters. So it did happen. I mean, it happened a fair share. The joke is, of course, that those guys are all gone. The team doesn't have much of anything left. It won't be used much this upcoming season. I think that's fair to say, right?
Sure. Maybe.
Derek Jeter, the owner, one of the owners of the team, is considering taking it down. And again, he's not the only one who feels this way. We heard that Mayor Carlos Jimenez is also not a big fan. He's not a fan, but for a lot of other reasons.
Well, sure. I think, you know, there's a lot of things you can say about the mayor, but to his credit, he was, at the time that this deal went down back in 2009, he was one of the few elected county officials who actively opposed it. He said it was a bad deal and we would come to regret it for decades to come. I think he has been vindicated to a large degree. And so for him, I think the stadium as a whole, including the sculpture, really sticks in his craw. He has made no secret of what he would like done with it. I mean, believe me, if the sculpture burns down tomorrow morning, by the afternoon, the police will be at Mayor Jimenez's door asking him where he was.
You said it was, what, $2.5 million?
$2.45 million was the final price tag on the sculpture.
Is it worth
sculpture.
That much money?
Well, I mean, this is the funny thing about the art world. Something is worth what someone else will pay for it. Is there someone else out there who is dying to have a 74-foot-high sculpture with revolving metallic marlins and shoots jets of water? I don't have any friends who are looking for that right now. But if you know someone who does and they're willing to pay $2.45 million, sure.
You were saying, we were talking about if they take it down. I mean, look, it's almost $2 million, right, that we spent on
almost $2.5 million.
So it's not like you're going to take it apart and just throw it away.
And there actually are laws against cutting it up for scrap.
Okay.
There are, you know, the artist does have the right to weigh in on this. Red Grooms is not a prima donna. I think if the overwhelming majority of the people in Miami, including Mayor Jimenez and the new owner, Derek Jeter, want to see this thing removed from center field so you can actually, heaven forbid, see the Miami skyline while you're sitting in there. I know, crazy idea. I don't think Red Grooms would stand in the way. But I think he would certainly say, please don't destroy it, and you shouldn't. So it should be moved as a whole.
To where? Where would you move it?
Well, look, this thing is a monument to the county commission spending taxpayer dollars like water. I say move this thing right in front of County Hall. And anytime they pass a balanced budget without gutting public services, it goes off. So if they pass a budget and they don't have to slash, you know, all the bus routes again, boom, the fountains go, the Marlins spin around, the lights go off.
There you go. All right, so you know what? Before we finish up here real quickly, I mean, you brought up an interesting point, Brett, is that it's not like Derek Jeter or the Marlins can just go in there and take it down. There's got to be a process. There are rules.
There are, you know, in terms of moving it. But I do think that, I mean, we're laughing about the fact that this 70, I don't think it's 74 feet high sculpture is very kitschy, but it is very representative of some serious political problems that we have here in Miami. It is a stinging reminder of what happens when county officials are given carte blanche with tax dollars. And, you know, it's a reminder that happens to shoot out water and have Marlins spinning around, but it still holds.
Again, Brett Sokol, arts editor of Ocean Drive magazine and contributing writer of arts and culture for the New York Times. Thanks so much, Brett. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was a conversation we had with Brett Sokol, arts editor of Ocean Drive magazine and regular contributing writer of arts and culture for the New York Times. And he was sharing his thoughts on what should happen to Homer, the home run sculpture at Marlins Park. Now, recently, the county commission killed plans to move the Red Groom's art piece to Museum Park. The sculpture remains in Marlins Park for this season until Miami-Dade officials can come up with another location. The artist does have the right, by the way, to reject plans to move it from the stadium. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Today, again, is National Walkout Day. That was created as a protest against gun violence in the wake of the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. Now, earlier, we heard a little bit of a piece from video that WLRN reporter Tim Padgett and Katie Lepre gathered from Stoneman Douglas. They couldn't speak to any students or teachers because they actually couldn't leave the school grounds. But we also talked to WLRN reporter Nadege Green. She was at Turner Technical Arts High School in North Miami-Dade, and she has this report on what happened there.
At first, I was at Miami Central High School, and I didn't notice any kids coming out. And I called the school, actually, to ask them if they anticipated students would be walking out. And the person who answered the phone in the front office said, no, students would not be allowed off campus. And then I went right next door where Turner Tech High School is, which is next door to Miami Central. There's a lot of police presence at the school here at Turner Tech High School. Kids did come outside, but they were outside in the courtyard in the assembly area. And you could hear them chanting, what do we want? Gun control. When do we want it? Now. There was a small program that lasted about 30 minutes where different students got up and spoke. I could hear pieces of it from where I was standing on the sidewalk because media was not allowed in the school. And I also spoke to a few students from where I was standing because the fence, there was a chain link fence separating me and the kids. But a few of them came to the fence and spoke with me. And I spoke with one student. His name was Josh. And he said he's a senior at Turner Tech. And he was just talking about how what happened at Marjory Stoneman was a tragedy. And it has really rallied them to not just address school safety and mass shootings, but also neighborhood level gun violence. He talked to me about one of his friends who was killed by gun violence. And he also said today the school allowed students not to show up in uniform. So if you wanted to wear a rest in peace t-shirt or memorial shirt honoring a loved one or someone you knew who was killed by gun violence, you could do so. And memorial shirts are very popular in Miami-Dade County after someone is killed, typically by gun violence. There are t-shirts that are made, RIP t-shirts. And so a lot of the kids wore RIP t-shirts of people who they knew were killed by gun violence. And so for them, this was very personal as well.
Now, the ACLU says that students are allowed to walk out of campus, leave campus if they want to, but the school didn't want that to happen.
Correct. Miami-Dade County Public Schools' direction was that students should stay on campus. According to the ACLU, that's a suggestion, right, that schools may prefer students to stay on campus, but it is actually their right to walk off campus in a protest if they wanted to. And also that walking off campus for a protest would be the equivalent of skipping a class, essentially. And so you couldn't punish kids, or it would be the equivalent of an excused absence. So you couldn't get punished more harshly for doing so. At Turner Tech, however, the kids were deterred. It looks like they were deterred from walking off campus. You saw staff, school staff was around the perimeter of the school. They also set up police cars around the perimeter of the school. I counted no less than at least 6 or 7 police officers. Some were on bicycles as well. Now, I'm not sure whether or not the police officers would have been able to take any action if the students did decide to walk off campus because technically they're not breaking any law by doing so. But I'm sure that also served as a deterrent for students who may have wanted to walk off campus. They did not.
Whether you did today or have wondered if at any point, have you spoken to any teachers or administrators? I'm curious what they think about all of this and how much more involved students seem to be.
I didn't speak to any teachers today, but in the past few days, like listening to teachers, they're proud of their students. Many of the teachers that I have interacted with, they're actually happy to see this wave of activism among students, regardless of what side you're on, whether or not you're more conservative or liberal, that this is an opportunity to have conversations about democracy, to have conversations about rights, and to see the intersection of what you're learning maybe in your government class in real life. And so some teachers are absolutely using this as a teaching tool and a model in their classrooms because it's actually playing out in real life.
Obviously, we have the march that's coming up in D.C. Later this month. Are any of the students that you spoke to, have they planned to go there, or would there be more marches here on the same day?
There will likely be more marches here. I didn't speak to any students who planned on attending the marches, but I have heard from some of the organizers and people in the community that there will be kids from Miami-Dade County Public Schools who will attend that march. I know that there's at least one person who is looking to sponsor children from, you know, different schools who might not be able to afford it to be able to attend the march. So I do think they're still planning, but that is definitely in the works, and there will be students from Miami-Dade represented there.
Again, that was WLRN reporter Nadege Green covering the National Walkout Day at Turner Technical Art High School in North Miami-Dade.